assume your current wife.
Very good. Very good, Craig. Good work. Good work. Nice work. That's right. That's right. That's right.
In 1982, he entered the LAPD Academy. Upon graduation, he was assigned to Rampart Patrol, and since then he's worked homicide in Wilshire area, Pacific area, Foothill area, and the abused child unit. He's worked gangs in Rampart and Hollywood. He's worked sex crimes in Hollywood. He's worked as the department coordinator, which is LAPD's for expert, for detectives, domestic crimes, and hate crimes. He coordinated the first five annual LEAPS conferences, LEAPS being the acronym for Law Enforcement and Private Security. He instructs for LAPD and private institutions in police procedures, detective procedures, interrogations, search warrants, and criminology. He supervised Rampart crash during the infamous Rampart scandal.
I wasn't there when the bad stuff happened.
That's right. I was always out of the room. That's right. I wasn't there.
And for all you screenwriters in the room, he is a technical advisor for CBS. Detective Heather Gary, she's also a local. She was born and raised in Santa Clarita. Her grandparents were from Hollywood, and her great-grandparents lived in the Hollywood Hills. But she relates not so much to geography as to the color of her blood, which is police blue. her grandfather was an LAPD sergeant in the 30s and 40s. You could say he gave his life to the LAPD since he died of a heart attack playing basketball on the academy court.
Wow.
Her cousin was a sergeant detective in the LAPD. Her uncle was an LAPD captain working out of Hollywood in the 70s before going on to be chief of police in Seal Beach. Her great-granduncle was the youngest man ever to make sheriff in Amarillo County. And she's been married for 17 years to an LAPD sergeant. Detective Gary was always drawn to law enforcement. She was an LAPD Explorer Scout at 15. She worked security for a major theme park near her home, Magic Mountain, so to speak. When she was 18, she earned a degree in criminal law and attended classes put on by the California Gang Investigators Association in 1994 at the annual California Homicide Investigators Association conference by attending official programs on DNA and law enforcement investigation techniques. As a testament to her dedication, she's a cancer survivor who continued working throughout her chemotherapy and radiation treatments. In her spare time, she has a 16-year-old boy and a 12-year-old girl. When I asked our distinguished detectives how they'd like me to introduce their talk today, I received two different but thematically linked responses. Detective Barron suggested we call it the dinosaur and the dilettante. And Detective Gary suggested Beauty and the Beast. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome you to Homicide Investigators Insights from the Old Guard and the New.
All right. Thanks, sir.
You're welcome.
I guess I'm going first. I'm not selling you a used car, but if I talk real fast, that's so you guys can get to Hill, you know, we don't spend too much time. We always have a million stories, and the stories are some good, some not so good. But let me back up two steps and tell you how I met Heather. I met Heather when I was working Hollywood Sex, and she came back while she was first undergoing cancer. And that is part of the reason why Heather works for me now in Foothill Homicide. Not the only reason, but part of the reason. Because throughout her treatment, she kept working, which is highly unusual in a government job where you can just, okay, I'm done, go home and take the pension or the medical. So my hat's off to Heather. As always, that's half the reason she works for me. The other half, I'll give you out of a story at a crime scene. I'm leaving the station. It's 4 o'clock and Heather's on a day off. And I hear a radio call come out and it's a shooting that just occurred. And I'm like, okay, it's a shooting. Okay, I know it's going to be a murder. Pretty sure because of where it is. So I'm going to head over there by Van Nuys and Dronefield. I head over there and we hear from the hospital, yeah, the kid's dead. Okay. All right. So I'm already there. Now, I'm in my scrubbies because I've left work, so I'm in, you know, cut off shorts and a t-shirt, and I was on my way home. Heather's at home because she's on her day off. Well, so I'm going to call Heather out to the scene because it's going to be her and her partner to handle. So by the time I've gotten there, we've already had 30 cops throughout this location. This location is a wide open field. And when I say wide open, we're talking 3/4 of an acre that's got a couple areas fenced off that they've cut down these fences. So we've got all these cops that have gone through there looking for evidence. We've got all these firefighters. And when we get to a scene, we're looking for whatever we can. And one of the things I have to keep reminding our young patrol officers is, hey, dirt. Stay off the dirt because I can get tire impressions. Mm. I can get shoe impressions. And young cops don't get that. They're looking for the gun, the bullet, the casing, the this, the that. But I've had the entire gang unit. I've had at least 6 patrol units, which is 12 cops. I've had more than 50 cops and more than 30 firefighters going through this area, looking. Nobody's found anything, all right, except this. We believe it happened right around this tree. So I'm out there holding the scene, waiting until Heather and Jose show up so they can take over the scene. And I'm waiting. I'm thinking, God, we got to have something. I'm looking. I'm not finding. I mean, I can see the gurney. I'm looking. So I can see the gurney spots where the fire department has brought the gurney in and taken the gurney out. That's not evidence for me, but it's, you know, an indication of where everything happened, where they actually picked up the body. And now it's getting dark. It's like 6, almost 6 o'clock, and here comes Heather. And Heather walks up, you know, with the flashlight like we always do, and she says, so what do we got here? I said, we ain't got shit. Oh, I apologize. I won't say any words that you won't write. I said, Heather, we ain't got shit. She's like, well, what about that casing? What? That casing right there. About 4 feet away from me, there's a casing. It's the single casing from the single shooting in this 3/4 of an acre lot that everybody has been by. She's there, and this didn't happen once. This has happened 3 times since Heather's been working for me. And that's one of the reasons, just one of the reasons, besides her personal character, that she's such an important part of my team in Foothill Homicide. I don't just have stories from Foothill Homicide. I mean, just over 29 years, I've worked a lot of different cases and a lot of different kinds of cases. Some of them, you know, bring a tear to your eye, and others, okay. We had a case on Sharp Street where when we get there, I'm glad somebody killed this guy because had I come across him and known him personally, I might have been tempted. This gentleman, McCrotchian? Well, the other one was Ivan Chaydez, if you don't remember. Ms. McCrotchian had a...
Merketchian.
I'm not real good with the IAN there. Merketchian. He'd been cheating on his wife. He'd been cheating on his girlfriend. That doesn't make you worthy of being killed. But when he was selling dope, he was cheating his customers. He was shorting his dealer. He was... Yeah. Nice kid. Yeah. He was extorting a kid over a car that the kid got impounded nobody picked up out of impound. So he said, oh, don't worry about it. You just owe me $3,000.
Oh, wow.
And the day we came in with the evidence and we're booking it, you know, because we always get called out 2-3 o'clock in the morning. We're booking the evidence. Our major crimes unit shows up at the station asking for background on our victim. And we're like, what are you here for? We're doing this. Are you taking the case? What are you talking about? Well, it turns out, the victim of the extortion, they were going to start doing surveillance based on his behest on our dead guy. Mm. So we're like, we know where he is. Ms. McCrotchian, somebody. We still don't know exactly who, because... we got over 20 suspects. But they were upset with him. And I can tell you, and I don't know for sure that they held his hair like this, but I'm going to guess, because he had 6 shots to the face. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So somebody was upset with him. Okay, and you can't use his name because that's still an open case, but that's the kind of thing we deal with. And it's sometimes when you're out there, think, oh my God, this poor kid. And then you learn out about him later, you're thinking, I'm glad somebody got to him before I did. I just can't imagine how you could live a life that was that selfish and self-centered and stay alive into your 20s.
And you never closed the case?
No, that case is still open. We have several suspects. That's the problem. We have several suspects.
Oh, no, we know who did it.
Yeah. Shh. That's the problem. We have several suspects. And we come across that kind of thing on a regular basis. We had a woman killed whose name I can't use because it was really recent. Who, when you think about it, it's like, well, how, in fact, Heather did that crime scene. It's like, how do you have such a small window where she's there, we know she's there, and somebody leaves the location, and pop, 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 somebody's in the back house, they hear rounds fired. And there's police are there within 2 minutes, and they're in the house searching, and we don't have a suspect. I mean, such a small window. And so I can't really talk about that one. That one's way too fresh. But I'll back up to another one that I had years ago at in when I was in Wilshire. We had a case, I can't remember the name of the theater. It was on Rodeo Road, not Rodeo Drive, but Rodeo Road. And we have a kid who's supposed to change the marquee. And so he's dealing with the ladder for the marquee. And as he sees this victim standing outside, evidently, ostensibly waiting for somebody. And he's taking the ladder down. So he takes the ladder down and goes to go inside. He passes our main witness. And as he gets inside, he sees a commotion of people going the other way past him, and he turns around, and the victim is dead. Okay. Now, our main witness comes out the door. She sees the victim fall, and she runs up to him, and she sees a dark figure run past the theater, between the theater and the fast food place, and gone. So who's in the driveway of the fast food place? 4 undercover police officers. Okay. So who do they catch? They catch the kid who's coming out of the theater past the guy with the ladder because he says, oh, shit, there's somebody dead here. I got a warrant for my arrest. I better get out of here before the cops get here. So he takes off running, and the 4 undercover officers who are waiting for their who are doing surveillance jump out of the car because they, hear a shot. And so somehow our suspect literally disappeared. Somehow he either got past them or continued to run straight and nobody saw him. And that kind of a case is like, it's a heartbreaker. Because you got this window of opportunity where, damn it, we should have had it. We had enough resources there where we should have had it. Interesting story about that one is I've been working homicide about 2.5-3 years. I hadn't made detective yet. I was a police officer 3. And so I'm there working homicide. I'm out, again, 2 o'clock in the morning, over the dead body, scratching my head. I had just been to a new homicide school, and so I'm rolling my flashlight on the ground to get what we call the oblique lighting to see if you can get evidence to glint up. And so I'm rolling my flashlight. My partner, who was an old-time detective, too, standing back there, and I'm like, Pat, can I go to the body yet? No, just a minute, Frank. Wait, just wait. And so I'm doing this, and I'm like, because I want to come up with something that's going to solve this case. Because I already know we got a problem with our witnesses. Because this is an employee and the kid who grabbed him, and we don't have our suspect. And so in the morning, the next morning, I'm at my desk, and my mom calls me. And, yeah, Mom, how's everything going? She says, well, you guys had a murder in Wilshire. I said, yeah, Mom, I know. It's my case. She says, oh, no. This is, out in the field. I said, what? She says, yeah, I saw on the TV. I saw a couple detectives standing over a dead body. I said, Mom, that was me. No, I'm talking about out in the field. I said, Mom, what do I do? You work Wilshire Homicide. Yeah. What does that mean? You handle the homicides in the office. Okay, so I couldn't explain to my mother that I actually dealt with bad people outside of the police station because she didn't have a concept of it. I don't know how much more you want. I could keep going. I don't want to take up too much of your time. And huh? Oh, the diaper story.
All right, here we go. Yes.
Okay, back in Wilshire again, Frank Bishop and I are working a case, and kind of a real serious case. We had, it turns out we had Salvadoran guerrillas who were kicking MS-13 off the street to deal drugs at night.
Wow.
And they were pretty sophisticated. Their concept was, we don't start working until 10 o'clock because at the time, and this was back in the late 80s, LAPD narcotics knocked off at 10 o'clock so they wouldn't get overtime and didn't come to work before 4. So the Salvadoran guerrillas figured, we just kick the MS gangsters off the street for that time, and that's when we'll sell drugs because it's safest. Well, they killed 2 people and shot a third, and the whole story is long and convoluted, and it involves a woman. But when we actually finally go and make the arrest, we're hitting an apartment, which was their stash location, where they kept all their guns. And so Frank Bishop, the guy who I succeeded in Foothill Homicide, is assigned the alley. And he's assigned the alley on the side where the window is. So in case somebody tries to jump out the 4th floor window and get away, it's his responsibility to stop them. And so when we hit the door, the guns all go out the window. You know, 3 or 4 AK-47s, 4 or 5 handguns. And they drop 4 floors and hit the ground. So we're in court, and it's Frank's job to testify as chain of custody how we came into these and prove that they came out of that window. And so the defense attorney holds up a picture. He says, well, we see the guns there on the ground. He says, but there's a lot of other debris in the alley. Well, yes, there is, and there's a diaper there. And so can you tell us with 100% surety that it wasn't the diaper and other trash that they threw out of the window? And Frank's response is something to the effect, while he's on the stand, of, I've been a father for 10 years. I know the difference in the sound of a loaded gun or a loaded diaper hitting the And the jury just started laughing. It was one of those situations where you can't undo it, right. You know, because at that point they're like, okay, those guns came out of that. Tell you one more story. I had a case where, you know, we all deal with Miranda. In 1982, when I came on the job, you know, Miranda wasn't new. It had been here for over 10 years. However, they were refining how it worked. And I was being told by my training officers, don't worry, the Supreme Court's going to get smart. They're going to understand. Miranda doesn't work. They're going to throw it out. As you can see, that hasn't happened. I get a case, working auto theft, where 2 guys steal a truck so they can steal this Camaro. Firebird. They really wanted this Firebird. And so it's probably about 1984, 85. So I get the guys in custody. I talk to one. He waives his rights. Why are we there? We stole the truck so we could steal the car. Okay. So I go to the other guy. I advise him of his rights. He says, I don't want to talk to you. I want an attorney. Okay, well, the rule says I can't use anything that you say now. I can still ask questions. So, okay, I can't use it, guy. Tell me what happened. We stole the truck so we could steal it. Okay, thanks. So I take it to the DA's office expecting them to file one against the one guy because although I can put him in proximity, there's no prints on the Firebird, there's nothing else that ties the guy standing next to the stolen truck to the case other than his out of Miranda statement. Mm. DA says, screw him. I'm filing on both these assholes that got rap sheets. Okay, I'm not the one who has to prove this in court. You are. So we get into court, go through the whole testimony. Yeah, you advised my client? Yes. He waived? Yes. What'd he say? He told me that they stole the truck so they could steal the car. Okay, you advised my client? Yes. Did he waive? No, he didn't. So I'm thinking we're done. He says, and detective, isn't it true at that point you continued to question my client? Yes, I did. And what did he say? Okay, I'm sitting there, and I look at the DA, and the DA goes, and I look at the judge, and the judge gives me the raised eyebrow, and I said, he said they sold the check to the CL car. And the defense attorney says, whoa, what? He said they sold the truck so they could steal a car. Wait a minute. So you're saying, could you slow down, please? You're telling me my client told you that they were going to steal the car by stealing the truck. Yes, that's what I'm telling you. Well, Your Honor, that's an Adam Miranda statement. And the judge looks at me and says, and there's only one way it could have been said in this courtroom. That was true. I mean, they copped a plea after that. But it's those kind of things where you're, is this really happening? You know, it's a Twilight Zone moment. I'm going to let Heather go. Yeah, I could give you more stories later, but I want to make sure she gets some time.
Okay. This is my first time speaking in public. So I thought I'd do a little game first, just break the ice for me. Okay, so everybody, pick a number between 1 and 7 in your head. All right, yeah. We're going to do some math. Okay, you got the number between 1 and 9. I want you to subtract 5.
Oh, man. Oh, okay. Okay.
Subtract 5 from that number. All right, and then multiply that number by 3. All right, now you got your number. Square it.
Oh,
man. Okay. It should be a small number if anybody needs to get their iPhone or calculator.
All right.
Now, if you have more than 2 digits, add those 2 together. Okay? And keep adding those 2 digits together until you're back to a single number. Okay. Now, if you have a number that's less than 5, add 5. If your number... if it's more than 5, subtract 4. Okay. Is everybody caught up with me? All right. Now multiply that number by 2. Okay. Okay, subtract 6. Okay. Now take that number and correspond it with the alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, okay? So the corresponding number is the corresponding letter of the alphabet. Okay, so use that number or that letter and come up with a country in Europe.
Oh, jeez.
Now you got your country. Now use the second letter of that country and come up with an animal. A four-legged
animal.
Oh, for the love of God. This is a homicide.
Right,
four-legged
right.
animal.
Okay. Yeah, it is a lot of work.
Now a color of that animal.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Okay. Did anybody have the gray elephant in Denmark?
Oh, yeah.
Deutschland. Okay.
That's freaking.
Okay. So you got a bunch of irrelevant stuff. You put it together, and you're going to come to really one conclusion.
There you go.
There's my math.
There you go.
You should have come up with a 4, then you get the D. The only D country, there's 2, but the other one's spelled really weird and nobody would know it. So you got Denmark. Second letter is an E. Four-legged animal is going to be an elephant and gray. So.
Oh, four-legged.
Oh,
four-legged.
Okay, that's what
oh,
yeah.
Yeah,
eagle.
It's an eagle.
Four-legged.
Yeah,
eagle.
Yeah, and then you get the color you're going to get. All right, class.
Yeah, kids.
So your point is...
My point is, I just thought that was fun. That's just something, you know, it's just you, for the homicides and going to trial and doing everything, is you get a bunch of information, you put it together, and you come up with one logical answer. And that logical answer most people should come up with. There may be some differences if people don't know math. There may be some differences, but that's how homicides basically work. We go out there, we pick up all these little pieces, and we put this all together into one logical conclusion. Where can other things happen? Yeah. Something, yeah, maybe. Is it probable? Yeah, no, not likely. And that's the homicides for basics.
How often are you wrong?
Me? Never. I am never
wrong. That's never wrong. That's it.
You're like having to God.
That's it.
And like he says, he brings up these cases. Yeah, Nurkechian, he's an AP gang member, and it's mafia related, you know. His own people take him out. You're not going to get nothing out of that. And who comes in, you know, the informant that night says, you know, we get this undercover unit calling and saying, hey, is Happy dead? Yeah, Happy's dead. And Happy. How did you know? And we told him, the only way you know is if somebody was there.
Yeah.
That's the only way you're going to know. And turns out that the guy that told him is the one that did it. So, but, you know, that's all with their FBI stuff, so it's kind of above me. And then, you know, other things, and that's one thing with homicides is we do have to go into everybody's lives. We had that lady that was killed in her home recently. Seemed like a very nice housewife.
Mm.
Nice wife, nice kids, everything, until I get her phone records.
Wow.
Until I get the phone records.
Yeah.
I want to know who this woman's talking to, who she's friends with, because people don't just walk into a house, don't take nothing and kill somebody.
Mm.
You know, and now I got to go through all the boyfriends to figure out who had the beef. So, you know, people aren't what they seem on the outside, and that's one thing I learned. I worked Hollywood Patrol for many years. And going into these houses in Hollywood, these celebrities and high, you know, people up in the hills, people aren't what they seem, you know, and you can never really judge a book by its cover. You really got to get underneath everything to find out what the truth is. And that's one thing I've learned. Yes.
So how'd you go about getting those phone records, by the way?
It's a search warrant. A search warrant.
So you had the phone company, obviously.
Yes, yes. And you are safe. There's only one company that keeps text messages. So unless you have Metro PCS, your text messages are clean.
Interesting.
Why did they tell you what?
They were on the phone.
Yeah, they were.
Okay. So if you delete it, once you send it, most companies don't keep your phone records.
Interesting.
At least they'll say you sent a text from this phone to this phone.
Right.
Metro PCS does keep your records for a while, so we can read it. Other ones, it just shows to and from.
You guys still keep murder books?
Yes, that's my writing. I am the author of many murder books. But, yeah, we do have murder books,
yeah.
And that's where we keep everything organized.
Right.
The LAPD murder books?
Yes, yeah. yes, our blue binders. So trying to think of some stories for me. I have to write things down because I'm not that great at this kind of stuff. My partner in homicide, I've been working with him for about 3 years. Older male Hispanic, Jose, he's my partner. Typical older male Hispanic, very old school, very traditional. He calls me Rain Man. Because I am, I guess, more of the, you know, hey, what's that number? You know, what's this, what's that? And I know it. So he calls me Rain Man. I'm that. But the funny thing with Jose is he is scared to death of dogs. Okay? I don't have a problem with dogs. I like them. And just the other night, where we just had a homicide on Sunday, Super Bowl Sunday. So we're out canvassing, and canvassing is basically, we just keep going to the crime scene until we find people that can talk. And we just keep hounding them, because homicides are solved on your feet, going to people's houses, finding your witnesses. Nobody wants to talk. We work in Foothill Division, which is Pacoima, Tahunga, Lakeview Terrace, Sun Valley, and parts of Sunland. And all Sunland, I guess. Yeah, that's it, right? So we mostly work gangs. For the majority, Pacoima is Hispanic gangs, and that's what we work. And Hispanic gang members have a lot of dogs in their yards. Mm-hmm. So we're canvassing last Thursday, and I'm behind him walking up and run into the back of him, and he's, ah, shit! And he turns and he runs. And I'm standing there, and there's just some big bowls. Just big bowls. And I'm just standing there, and then there's a dog just tied up, laying on a big bowl-looking white, ratty-looking dog. I turn around and I'm like, I'll get the door. Because he's back there behind the fence. And that's happened a few times with him. I've gone into places. I've walked up to pit bulls. You know, it's wow. Like, you know, you can tell dogs are easy. You know, if their little butt's going, you know they're going to be happy. You walk up and you sense it. But he stays behind the fence. That's Jose, my big tough partner. I'm behind the fence because of a big bull or a big dog house. And I'll go up to the door for him.
Is the 48-hour theory true?
Bullshit.
The thing with the 48 hours, in my opinion,
I'm sure they're pony for us.
Can you explain most, that to some of us?
Okay. They say that your best clues are going to be in the first 48. If you don't find somebody within the first 48, your chances are slim. Most of our cases are solved relatively quickly. The issue with it is the information we get isn't court eligible. I mean, there are people that aren't going to tell you. There are people that aren't going to go in court, and it's rumors. Well, I heard from Scooby down the street that Scrappy did it, and, you know, from the flats, you know. We have a thing with ours is for a while we had a bunch of homicides, and everybody was saying it was spooky. Spooky from the flats. And so that's our joke. Whenever we don't know who did it. Spooky from the flats.
Also part of the 48 hours is what you need in the first 48 hours is anybody who was there to get them tied to a statement before they talk to somebody else and their information gets tainted. And I'll give you a perfect example. We had a case on Laurel Canyon where we get there and patrol points out two casings to us. And so we're like, we got a nice little crime scene. We got two casings and a bicycle. Not a big deal. Kid's dead. He's gone to the hospital. Okay. We got two witnesses we're talking to. In talking to the witnesses, our witnesses repeat back to us, evidently, that there were two shots fired. Okay. Not Heather and Jose, but Mario and his partner at that time come. They find a third casing. So what's wrong with our witnesses telling us there were two shots? They were influenced by what either patrol or we had told them, which is what we don't want.
Right.
That's why, oh, why don't you guys give the information to the press? Because they'll broadcast it. Because they're not interested in us solving the crime. They're interested in getting ratings by getting the information out first.
So that's the first 48. But, yeah, so with my partner, being old school as he is, when we try to find a place, he reaches for the Thomas guide. I grab my cereal. And that's just how it goes. And I'm like, we're the little blue dot. And he's flipping through the pages. I can't read that. I go, we're the blue movie dot. Him on his flip phone trying to text his kids with an ABC. So I work with him. I'm their computer geek. I'm the one that does the computer stuff. I'm their technical person. Unfortunately, we're not like TV. It's, you know, it's just us. I got my dog scared partner who doesn't know how to use an iPhone. And I'm the computer geek. But we're talking about court. And some funny things from court is what happens at our crime scenes. You know, we go through. And everything has to be measured and photographed and numbered and, you know, put the little tents and the numbers and the letters and all that fun stuff. So I'm doing that at our crime scene. And I like to try to find everything because once you do all the numbers and the photos, if you find something later, it kind of looks off to say, well, why wasn't that in? So I'm flipping through, lifting the couch, moving things around, trying to find a knife. Our guy was stabbed. So I'm just kind of going through it. So come back a couple years later, we're in trial on this. And the defense expert comes up to the stand, because we did get a confession, and made it through our false confession witness that, you know, we didn't coerce him or threaten him or anything that, you know, we get the reason. You know, this guy was mildly mentally retarded, was the defense expert witness excuse for what happened to, why this man was stabbed. And he based that opinion on talking to the man in his low education and based on the condition of his apartment, which was a converted garage. Especially the couch, which had been moved a little bit, the cushions were off, and the blanket over was kind of askew. I'm sitting there next to the prosecutor, and I lean over, and I'm like, I did that to the couch. That was me. And so I have to get up on the stand after the expert talked about how mildly mentally retarded this defendant was and explain that I was the mildly mentally retarded that moved the couch. So it's just funny things, you know, that you're dealing with in court. And, you know, it's a good thing for the jury, too, because it is really boring in court. There's a lot of technical.
He doesn't know right from wrong, and that's the point.
Yes.
Yeah.
He knows right from wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
so. Who cares if he's mildly mentally retarded? He's still.
It's the defense. Well. It's, you know, they have to put on a defense, and they're going to pay this guy $3,000 to fly down from wherever he came from to sit there and talk about mild mental retardation because the couch looked like somebody, you know, moved it around. Which is me.
But you took it away from him.
Right? I took it that away, and I felt bad for that. But he was guilty anyway. Let's see. So, basically, in my boss or in the introduction did say that I go to a lot of training. I've been through criminal profiling with the FBI school. I've also gone through the behavioral analysis training with the body system. And to do talk about liars, and so far it works really good on 16-year-old kids.
That's great.
My son is not going to get away with anything.
Yes. Will you explain that a little bit?
Body is Behavioral Analysis Training Institute. Basically, it's learning through people's responses, physical responses, their body, their faces, everything, when they're lying, when they're telling the truth. And basically with that, is you get a baseline. This is good for poker. Really good for poker. Really good. Really good. Especially when you're I used to be blonde. I dyed my hair red, you know. So today it's red. But I am, you know, when you're the blonde sitting in the corner, they don't pay much attention to you. So you can get all their money because they forget you're even playing. But when you get a baseline on somebody, and a lot of times during your interview, you're going to talk to your witnesses, your defendant, whoever it is, your suspect. You don't know if it's a suspect or witness, and you're going to get their baseline read. You're going to ask them easy questions that you know they're going to tell the truth to. You know, you talk about their family, talk about their kids, and you're going to see where they're comfortable and what their body language is for basic ones, because everybody's going to do something different. You can't just say, oh, you're looking to the left, mm-hmm. you're thinking you're lying. You're fiddling with your hands. I'm a fiddler. If I'm sitting right here, if I'm sitting and listening, I'm going to have a page full of doodles because I doodle. Doesn't mean I'm lying or I'm listening, but I'll have a page full of little drawings. I think when I was trying to write this out, I actually ended up drawing a little USC Trojan head.
Because is that a sign of mild mental
which just goes along with that, which is okay.
Right,
you got to be a little deficient to do my job.
Right.
Do you have a way of tracing people's family relations? Like, for example, let's say you have an immigrant coming in from El Salvador and they're involved in crime and you suspect that they have relatives here and so on. How do you uncover their entire relative connection? Is there a way to do that? And if so, how do you do that?
The best way to do that is phone records. You find out who their friends, who they talk to. You go through their phone records. We have FBI, and we also have contacts in some countries. El Salvador, we do have contacts with El Salvador. Some countries, it's going to be hard. Like with our country, with the Armenian power guy, Happy, that was killed. That's more difficult because we don't have relations with Armenia.
What about Israel?
Israel, we do have better relations with Israel, but a lot of the foreign nationals, and you know, if they come here and we know where they live, I could run people and find people that have also used that house. We have a system called CLEAR, which is, I don't know what it stands for, but basically I can run you in CLEAR and I can find out how much you paid for your house, where do you live, who else was registered at that house, who you got it from, who your neighbors are. Possible family members that may have used that house with you, and then it will track your other houses that you've lived in and give me family members and people that at the same time were using that address.
Is that national?
That's
yes.
Scary.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Big Brother is very, very big.
It's not as scary as Google.
Yeah.
We actually use Google as a starting point.
I do Zaba searches. I do, and I've actually taken all my stuff off of it.
Clear is just a police access.
Yeah, it's a police access, but also private people can purchase the access into Clear.
So it's any police station's computer.
Thompson Reuters, I think is what it is.
Any police station that pays for it.
We have a contract.
We have a real bad history. City of Los Angeles, we don't pay our bills. So ours goes up and down, and we don't get as good a connection. So that's why Clear is one of them. Used to be AutoTrack.
It was AutoTrack. Now it's Clear. It's actually the company is Thomas Reuters.
And, yeah, and one of the things that, like with AutoTrack, not as much with Clear, but with AutoTrack we used to do would be, so you got somebody in an apartment building at 1305 Santa Monica. Well, they're in apartment B. Well, we go through AutoTrack and we find out who's in apartment C and D, get a hold of them, and ask them about their neighbor. And then you've got information that parties don't know you're getting, as opposed to, oh, well, yeah, I tell you this is my story and these are the people I associate with. It changes the complexion of what truth is when you get it from the next door neighbor who hates him, who wants to tell you the dirt. Or public records, you call the ex-wife. Let me tell you what he did.
And another thing, you talk about Big Brother and the technology we have now with the police department. I know you've probably seen the cop cars that have the cameras on them.
Yeah.
Well, if I have a license and I want to know where this person has been, I can give my officers that license plate. They'll run it, and I'll pull up every picture that you've driven by a county camera, LA City and LA County. So we just had a homicide. I thought maybe this Lincoln Navigator was involved. I want to prove this guy has been up in this area before because he's on the west side and we're on the northeast. And I pull up photos, about 8 photos of him driving this car, just passing a police car, passing a traffic camera. So, yeah, there is a very big network. And then I can also run through it.
Hi.
Hello.
Sorry to interrupt. Anybody needing more water or refills or anything? We've got water here.
He just wants to hear the story.
So, like, to find that navigator, what was the search engine to find that? Was it looking for
cow gangs?
What was that?
Cow gangs.
LPR first, the license plate readers police departments have are on top of the car, and they are passive readers that read the license plates on cars, every car that it can pick up around them.
Wow.
It actually keeps a digital image of it, and it throws it in the computer, and it only alerts the officers if there's a want on that plate. So, although it only alerts the officer in the car at the time, she can go back later and run any license plate that will come up having gone through that system, because everyone was run through the system.
Basically, for me to get a license plate on somebody, okay, I knew a certain gang was involved. We have a tracking system called CalGangs, which is a state of California gang tracking system. Our gang officers talk to the gang members, find out their information. If they stopped in a car, they put that car license plate in there. So basically, through that, I knew this one gang was probably responsible for the shooting. I found the car I was looking for, the type, which was a Navigator, belonging to some associates that are in that gang. So that's when I take that license plate. I find everybody that's ever been stopped in it, or, you know, through our department resources, which picks up field interview cards, traffic citations. I can run the car for who's been stopped in it, and through all that stuff, any contact that we've had goes into the system. And that's how that works. And
tag them for a change.
Yeah.
So we do have a lot of resources to use, especially with the gang members. Go ahead.
I was going to divert you to when, how far into a case do you, either of you, have a fairly solid to very solid idea of who the killer may be or the perp, and then where does that occurrence come compared to the time when you actually nail him or her?
Depends on your story, Dan.
A lot depends on the case, because like I said, we handle a lot of gang cases. We pretty much know the other gang because when they do drive by and do their shooting, they shout out their gang name.
This is a trigger.
I could be mildly mentally retarded.
That's right.
What about non-gang
Yeah. Non-gang related, then you look at your victim.
Right.
I have the lady that was killed. It's going to be somebody that knows her. Right. You don't go into a house, not steal anything in the middle of the day, and shoot somebody in the head without a personal reason, and therefore you start with them. You find, and then I can go to her. I know who she's been in contact with. I know who she's talking to. I know who she's texting. I can go to their phone records and ping them and find out what area they've been in.
Right. Two men on a train doesn't happen.
Right.
You know,
right.
There's six, what we call 6 degrees of distance, where within six people, I'm going to know somebody.
Mm.
Okay, so no matter where they are on the planet, pretty much.
Mm.
And the two men on a train concept, it's extremely rare that an unknown kills somebody. There's a reason. There's a, some, you know, with the exception of serial killers, and even a serial killer is looking for a type.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they settle on a type. So you don't kill somebody you don't know, because what's the motive? What's the reason? Unless you're nuts. And if you're nuts, then you're going to do it again and again, and you're going to develop an MO, and you're going to have a type.
How far from rollout time till you get that feeling that it's got to
be the feeling. You usually get the feeling pretty quick on the higher percentage of your cases, but you have to remember, we're starting late. We don't know, like with McCracchi, we don't know that you've been cheating on your wife, you've been cheating on your girlfriend, you've been doing all this problem with drugs and everything else. We don't know that until we get through interviews, until we do some background on you. Now, other cases, you get there, you say, Tanish Vasquez. Okay, the husband did it. Pretty good. Pretty easy. He did it. You know, you get there, the house is made a mess. He's trying to blame the dog. You know?
So a few hours in many cases.
Sometimes the case is done in your head before you're finished with your paperwork for the night.
And then how often is that turn out to be dead wrong? And it's
somebody
very rare.
Three trains behind him or something.
Yeah, that's very rare. But like with McCracchian, you've got so many suspects you're starting with that you can narrow it down to a couple or three who have a strong motive and opportunity, because you have to have both. And then maybe you look for the alibis here, see if they fit.
Mm.
If they're real, you look for the alibis here, see if they fit, and then you narrow it down even more to one. But usually, you're pretty close to target within a day or two at the outset. The tough part
is it a feeling, or is it knowledge, or is it both?
Well, it's both, and some of it also has to do with what she's talking about. Heather's gone through a lot of training for interviews and interrogation. I actually teach interrogation. And part of what she's talking about when she talks about getting a baseline, you sit across the table from somebody, you do it long enough, you know that people have seen television shows like Lie to Me, where they have the forensic shit that we use.
Mm-hmm.
The only good thing about that is they can only fake parts of it. They can try and fake it, and they can... the worst people we have to talk to are hypes.
Hmm.
People who are addicted to heroin. Because they are good liars.
Hmm.
They're very good liars.
Hmm.
But they're good liars for short periods of time.
Hmm.
Their story holds water until you do one more interview. And then you're like, he's so full of shit. they can't keep the story.
They might keep
the same story, but their fact pattern is so far off base. Well, then I turned the corner and the green monsters came down. You know, it's just what they're giving you. They can't change enough of their storyline to fit your evidence. And your evidence doesn't change because you locked that down when you got there. And that's, you always go back to your evidence. Does it fit the, would it work? And would it work if, and yeah, sometimes people move evidence. Sometimes they create evidence.
Mm.
But it doesn't, you know, the concept of, well, this is what, I'm going to lay out the evidence, and so the police are going to follow this path. That works, maybe. The problem is, when we go through it with such a fine-tuned comb, and I don't train Heather how to do interrogations. She goes to the schools, maybe I'll sit behind her, maybe her partner will sit behind her, but she learns how to do it herself, because if I teach her how I do it, she's going to do it my way and miss a whole bunch of shit. So let her do it her way, and if I see something, I'll add on to it. Because now we got a broader base. And same thing when you're going forward with that investigation. I'm not going to tell her the most important thing is the casings or the tire tracks or the blood on the wall or the neighbor's statement. I'm going to let her do her thing, and then I'm going to say, hey, Heather, how do we talk to? Oh, yeah, we're going to get to that. And sometimes we don't talk to people that we need to talk to right away because we want to have everything else first in case they are the suspect.
What about in a robbery when it may, I mean, it looks like it's random, somebody kills somebody. Maybe there's a relationship, but maybe not. Maybe some guy just wanted to steal money. How can you tell whether there might be a filial link to that robbery or it's just a random?
We had a case, I'm not going to say on San Fernando, let's say it was on Glen Oaks. We had a case a couple years back. A guy goes in to rob a store, okay, a little ma-pa store, and one of the owners is behind the counter. Guy comes in, just hands him over the money. Guy's got I think it was a 25 in his hand, and there's two patrons in the back. They run, and it's a little place, so they can't run far. They run. He goes over, and he hits them up. I don't have any money. Well, you're in a store. How can you not have some money? But anyways, he hits them both up. They both say they don't have money. He goes like he's going out the store. Okay. Well, when he gets to the door, the owner shoots and kills him. A little problem when you come down to California law and federal law, which it's allowability. And as we're walking through the story with him, it clicks in his head and he says, oh yeah. He turned, he looked at me, and he raised his hand and pointed the gun at me to shoot me. Is that possible? It's possible. Is it probable? Flip a coin. Make a decision. I don't know. I do know that it turns out the kid worked there 3 years before for a couple weeks. And he had a mask on, but whether or not he recognized him, you know, whether I don't think the shop owner did recognize him. But I think the shop owner might have taken advantage of the second he had to make the shot. Can we prosecute him? No. I mean, it's a robbery. He had a gun. Was the gun operable? Well, it had bullets in it. They weren't the caliber of the gun.
Wow. Wow.
I thought about the reverse instance where somebody's the robber themselves is committing a murder. For example, they might commit a murder and then steal some drugs from the pharmacy in order to make the cops think they were just after the drugs and there really was no personal connection. So how can you tell? Well, that's just a cover-up for what they really wanted. Which
you might not be able to tell, and it might not matter. If you can make the case it's a robbery with somebody's killed, that's fine. You might not be able to tell, and your evidence might not give you that. That would be where you come into the biggest problem of those kind of things is where you have an actual hit. Where you have a hit, somebody is paid to kill somebody, and there's no physical connection between your shooter or your murderer and your victim. Okay, that's where you have the toughest time making your case. For the simple reason that all you have is the physical evidence at that scene that, you know, biologicals like hair, like saliva, like blood, off of your suspect to make them. Because if you have video, fine, but what does video give you?
What about the case of terrorism, where you may have, for example, a situation where nowadays we're much more, I guess the agencies network together much more to find out if some suspicious guy from Pakistan, for example, might have another motive. Maybe this guy's involved in some kind of a plot and that you would not know about unless the FBI has already been watching. There was a case years ago where the FBI monitored a guy because of his terrorist activities, and he killed his daughter as we were monitoring the phone. Actually, it was a book written about that. And this is how
we have never had a homicide where the FBI and some of our task force people were actually at the scene watching when the shooting went down.
No, that's not right.
Your body language?
That's it.
We've never had one of those. We've had them in Foothill. So the little part of the task force that where they were setting up surveillance on somebody associated with our victim, when the victim gets whacked in front of them. It's like, oh, shit. And luckily but trying to answer your question, when you talk about communication between agencies, okay, at certain levels, but for national security, oh, hell yeah. But we aren't involved in national security. And so when it comes to where we are, which is keeping people alive, keeping people from killing other people, there's very little communication. We don't share information with the sheriffs. They don't share information with us unless it's really important that we do. And what I mean by that is we tell them after the fact. We tell them when we're done. We tell them when...
I tell them everything.
We had a robbery victim who was killed 4 blocks out of our boundary in the sheriff's area. So the sheriff's knocking on our door because not this Heather, but another Heather that works my office is trying to find this guy to put him in jail for a robbery suspect, and he's dead. And he's dead just outside of our jurisdiction. So they're like, okay. So the sheriff shows up, and it becomes, what information are we going to share here? And it's not that we don't like each other. It's that their system leaks like a sieve. Our system leaks like a sieve.
What do you mean by leaks? What part of the system leaks?
I tell my captain something, I'm screwed. I'm serious. Okay, she doesn't tell me half of what she needs to tell me unless I demand it. Simply because I have a responsibility to tell up the chain a certain percentage of what I know and a certain percentage I have to keep back because my captain will turn around. I'll give you a perfect example. We had a girl kidnapped. Captain on the way home gets a call from the media. He's telling him everything about the kidnapping. We have an outstanding victim. Well, shut your mouth. They'll kill the outstanding victim to prevent themselves from being identified. You don't do that. My purpose is to stop people and prevent them from committing a future crime. Where that's because we're at a working level, where a captain's worried about, I want the community to feel safe. Well, they will feel safe as soon as I catch the asshole. Wait till I catch him before you tell them everything.
So that's a point, because you see this trope on all cop shows on TV. The captain comes to the homicide detectives and says, we need to solve this right now. I got the press on my ass. Does that happen?
Yes, it does. Every single day. Every day he's there. We need to solve. We need to end. Okay, boss, we're working on it. We got leads. That's what I'm telling you. We have leads.
We got hot
we're working
leads.
Hot leads.
What are you working? We have leads. I only know half the leads because I might make a mistake and tell them. Because honestly, and it's the nature of the beast that we have a reporting system you might be familiar with called ComStat, where we have everybody gets called downtown and we talk about stuff in a public forum. And in that public forum, it has happened before where people give away evidentiary information. Oh yeah, we're about to arrest so-and-so. You know, we're making the case and we're pretty sure we'll have enough to arrest him in the next day or two. Yeah. Where the hell do you think he's going? He's crossed the border in Mexico in a hot flash because they want to extradite him. You know, I mean, I'd be in Costa Rica, but he'd go to Mexico. And we've had numerous situations where how do you get somebody back, especially a Mexican national, from Mexico on a murder case? Doesn't happen. It's happened one time in the history of the United States.
How do you handle suspects? I mean, somebody that you can't arrest yet, but you're really looking at.
They're my best friend. And all of everybody I talk to, and that's just part of it, is even if they're witnesses and they're gangsters, whoever it is, I am just going to be the nicest person to them. Because, you know what, they're going to get arrested and they're going to call for me. And it happens all the time. I've had to go to San Francisco to talk to somebody because he wouldn't talk to them. He wanted me. And I get the information. And that's just part of talking to people is you got to build a rapport with them. You got to treat them like a person. Same thing with the biggest thing and the hardest one to interview are the sex offenders because the interviewer really has to relate with the sex offender. Say, I understand. Yeah, that four-year-old, she was asking for it. Wow. And you really got to stoop down and make them the victim.
Wow.
You got to make that guy the victim. You got to make your suspects the victim.
Wow.
On everything, you got it. And it's just, it's hard because I work sex crimes. They're the victim here.
Wow.
They are. They're the victim. And actually, the most difficult and the craziest ones is because they want to be in your thing, arsonists. Because arsonists, they want to help you. They want to be in there with you. They want to. They're out there helping, and they just want to know everything. And they're the ones that are more difficult. Sex offenders. If you make them the victim and you sympathize with them, they'll talk to you.
Wow.
Homicide guys, these gangsters, anybody, husbands, anybody like that, and that's how you get the confessions. Is you relate to them. You find out what's important to them. And so when you're talking to any suspect, you gotta find out what's important to them, whether it's kids, sports, family, maybe their dog, whatever it is that means something to them. You need to bring that into your interrogation. You got to bring your interview. You got to interview them. You got to get to know these people. Be their friend. Sympathize with them. Understand. Just be, you know, whether, you know, sometimes it works because I'm, you know, the female. My partner is the older male Hispanic. They're young Hispanic gang members. You know, they got the daddy figure, you know. You just find out what works, and that's what you use on
them. And I get to play the asshole a lot. Because I'm the boss. Like, I mean, I've done it before where I had two officers working a specialized unit. They caught this kid, and all they had him for was a stolen guitar. It was a Fendi, so it was a real nice guitar. But that's all they had. Well, when in Hollywood, when you had somebody who was addicted to drugs, was stole into some rock star's house and stole a Fendi guitar, it's not his first time. So I'm out there pounding on the door, tell him you got to get your fucking ass back and to handle some radio calls. If he doesn't want to help himself, if he doesn't want to tell you what he's doing, then forget it. Screw it. And so they're in there, oh, we're so sorry. Our boss is such an ass. we play the acting game because when I had a special problems unit, we didn't respond to radio calls. We were there all day to put him in jail. And so after about 10 minutes of this, I'm back on the door again. If he doesn't want, I got to have these radio calls handled. I need you guys back out in the street. And he's like, okay, I'll take you guys where I got the shit stashed. And he takes them. He's got four different stuff from four different burglaries. Two of them were from movie stars' homes, and the other two were just rich citizens of Hollywood. And all we had was a kid on the boulevard with a guitar, which was, you know, five times his annual salary. You know, that's all we had when we started with it. But the interrogation part, especially with sexual assault suspects, especially with people who assault children, it's all here. If you, oh, I'm disgusted with you. They shut down. They're not going to talk to you. That's it. You have to be empathetic. Wow. You don't have to say, yeah, I have sex with four-year-olds too. But you have to say, yeah, I can see how you could be enticed by this. This kid's special. So I can see how you could be enticed by it. But it doesn't make it right. But I can see how, you know, but in our society, the way it is, the way our laws are, you know, you're going to wind up in jail behind this stuff. So, but I mean, if you help me solve this case, I'll put in a good word for you at the DA's office. I do. I tell the DA they talk to me. Yeah. Also, over the years, you learn. When I was first doing interrogations, I was one of the reasons I got thrown in interrogations early was because I speak Spanish. And when I was working Wilshire, one of the reasons I got pulled into homicide so early was because nobody in the unit spoke Spanish. Mm-hmm. So every time, I mean, I remember before I was pulled into homicide, I was working a patrol. And I have point on an ADW suspect with a shotgun at the door, and they grab me and pull me back and says, homicide means you're back at the station. What? So I go back because they didn't have a Spanish speaker. Now, granted, things have gotten a lot better as far as Spanish speakers go in the department, but because of that, I got real good at especially speaking to Spanish speakers and getting them to tell their story. And I'm sitting with a senior detective. And I'm working robbery now, occasionally on lone homicide, but his name was Mel Smith. And Mel's this old-time black guy, worked homicide for 20 years, now he's back in robbery because he pissed off some supervisor. And he's sitting across from this young black kid who robbed a Korean liquor store. And Melvin sits down and he says, oh, let me show you how. So he's going to show me how it's done. I'm like, okay, I've been getting confessions in homicide. And so Melvin sits down and he's like, okay, goes through what we call a 510. We have a form on LAPD called a 510, and it's an information form. Starts with, you know, where do you get your hair cut? Where do you get to check your cash? And, you know, you're building rapport with the suspect. And he takes his pen and the paper, and he says, okay, young blood, tell me what the fuck you did this for. And I'm like, Melvin, I'm thinking in my head, you just completely screwed the pooch. He's going to shut down on you. He says, and Melvin's, I can't believe you walked in and ripped these people off. They give to your community. And the kid's back, the kid's there, steaming. He comes back, he says, they're fucking Koreans. They don't belong in my neighborhood. I had to rob him. Okay. And I didn't understand how Melvin got the confession because he fronted this kid. Yeah. He hit him in the face. And so afterwards, I'm like, Jesus Christ, Melvin, I thought you lost it because that's not the way I do confessions. I've been doing homicide suspects and sexual assault suspects and just let them tell their story and then come back with inconsistencies. I said, I thought you lost it. He said, no. I don't do a homicide like this. This kid's a robber. A robber is going to only understand you if you slap him in the face and you show that you're, you know, he went in with a gun to front somebody. You have to front him back. I'm like, oh, geez, that makes sense. So people approach him different ways, and different types of suspects need to be interviewed differently. You break it down to, I thought I was teaching a class of 30 people. Wound up being 180 people that the DA put on this training for. And they have this doctor set up four different typologies that commit domestic violence. So we had to come up with four different approaches for each typology. You know, whether it was somebody who was a sadist or somebody who was just, you know, had unfortunate circumstances that caused them to have a confrontation with their spouse. And so we set up four different ways to approach. If you could identify the typology, you had a higher degree of success using this approach. And each one of those would work in any situation. It's just not all of them would work from any individual detective, because some people can't pull it off. Heather pulls it off pretty well.
In the case of international terrorism, again, like the case of the Times Square bombing where the guy almost got away with killing a whole lot of people, do you have cooperation with agencies like Interpol or Israel that's got Shin Bet and Mossad and Pakistan? I mean, you know, because these are not local people, these are people, the reason being that whoever got them to do that, more than likely, is still somewhere and may get to do a similar crime. Perhaps they're trying to do multiple attacks.
Yeah.
So how, so this is not like a localized gang, employment type robbery.
I think, you know, I haven't had to deal with anything that big. I mean, I did have the FBI watching one of my victims, the Armenian, and they did have a lot of information they wouldn't tell us.
They
wouldn't tell me nothing. Mm. They'd just say, what do you have? Tell me. So I'm not going to tell you, you tell me. Yeah, you tell me. No, you tell me. And we walked out of there just pissed off at each other. Because they wouldn't tell us. And I wasn't going to tell them. And so I'm like, if you want to know, you have to take the whole case.
Mm-hmm. Their picture is a different size picture than what we're looking at. Mm-hmm. What we're usually looking at is, I want to put this person in jail for that act.
Right.
They're looking at, I want to prevent an incursion or something else.
Yeah, I'm looking at murder. They're looking at extortion.
Right. In a terrorism type situation, you will get whatever cooperation from that agency that either benefits them or is of no consequence to give you that cooperation. If it inhibits their investigation, sorry, you're not going to get it. Unless they can give you the entire case and still, sounds bad, still take credit for it once it's solved. Because that's, and I don't like to say it that way, but that's the name of the game. My bosses want to have credit for the cases we solve. If we don't get that credit, and I personally, I don't care if I get credit. I don't care what my clearance rate's right. Like, I care if I put the right person in jail for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's not true of everybody. Okay, because part of your promotability, oh, I'm retiring, so I don't worry about that. Part of your where you are in the organization depends on those numbers that they quote when you go to ComStat. You know, oh, I'm Captain So-and-so, and we had 100% clearance rate and robberies and burglaries and 60% clearance rate and homicides, and we're doing this, and this. And well, I'm never going to make lieutenant. They made that very clear to me years ago. So I'm happy.
Hmm.
So I'm not going up anymore. I'm going out, but before I go out, I hope I don't go down.
We're taking you down.
I've got a question about the murder books, the blue books that you keep going. Like, how much details as far as like you know, just minutiae, because in 2 years you're going to be called back to the stand and you've got to know everything.
Everything is in the murder book. We keep a chrono. So if it's something that's not
chronological,
record of everything.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So if it's something where I just go out and talk to somebody, but it's really kind of nothing I think of,
right.
I'll just write it in the chrono. At 2 o'clock, I went. This morning, I went to an autopsy before here. So if I kind of sticks to you, so I'll just note that in the thing. Went to the autopsy.
Some murder books get to be 3 and 4 volumes,
mm-hmm.
and some people think that we base it on the importance of the case.
Mm-hmm.
We really don't. We base it on how much stuff we put together.
Mm-hmm.
We start off with a 26 dividers, and the 26 dividers are an LAPD thing that LAPD came up with. You know, where the brilliant people came up with these dividers, and it starts off with, you know, your victim.
Chronos first.
Well, the chrono, but I mean, as far as describing information, your chronological report is extremely important for court purposes. Tell them what you put in the victim's section.
The victim, we have a victim section. You put everything on the victim. You put whatever you've done on the victim, his parole, hers, their rap sheets, their family, anything. If they died, if they lived long enough to give a statement, like their dying declaration, we'll throw their dying declaration in there. And dying declaration is court admissible for hearsay because it's something that they're dying and that's something that they say. They have to believe they're dying, though. Otherwise, you're going to die. Tell me who did it. You're dying. You're dying. I know you're going to die. I can see it. Tell me who did it. And that's a dying declaration. They are able to get out of a dying declaration. That's one thing we throw our officers in the ambulance with anybody going,
right, right.
Man, you're going to die.
So each section of that murder book, we pray section 14 is really beefy because that's our witness section. Section we take and we fill it with everything that we come across. So if the guy had, if the victim, you know, had brothers and sisters, it's going to be in the victim section. It's also going to be in 14 if we get a hold of them when we talk to them. So we're going to keep, you know, business cards, license plates, any kind of information we can. What's not, whatever doesn't get booked into property goes into that book. And they get sometimes 3 and 4 volumes. And it's not based on the nature of the victim. It's based on how much you put together on that case.
And some of it's junk that ends up, you thought you were going down this one path. You get a tip or whatever. You think, oh, this is it. So you get all these people, and it turns out, nope, that's all bunk. But you keep it in there.
Right.
It's part of your investigation. You know, you did it.
Time
it's spent. In there.
Yeah,
so it's going to stay in there. And
right, but that's one of the biggest problems when we talk about not telling the captain exactly where we are. Because we tell the captain, you know what, the boss, we're focusing on Craig. He's our person of interest. So what does he do? He tells his boss, they tell his boss, and then later I go and I arrest Jeff. I arrest Jeff because he's my shooter. I make him a witness, but what has he done? He's told the press he's a person of interest. Yeah, and as far as they're concerned, what does that mean?
Have access to the murder book? Is
I
give
the DA
so it's discoverable.
Well, once we make an arrest, we take everything to the DA. I will just bring a simple report, like a little 5-page report on just the basics for the DA. And then before we hit prelim, I'll make a complete copy of the whole murder book. I'll number it.
Wow.
You know, for each section. Section 1, page 123. Section 2, page 123.
Wow.
And I will make a complete copy. And then for our gang cases or any confidential ones, I also have to make a copy of everything for the defense. So with the defense, though, especially if I'm dealing with gangs or anything where I'm afraid for any of my witnesses, I redact it. Anything that says more than their first name. I'll have Susie B. And then the address, phone numbers, anything that can ID Susie B, besides her the name Susie, I will redact on the defense's copy. They'll get the whole copy of everything, but there'll be a lot of black just scratched out. Just to do what I can do to protect them.
Does that cause problems at trial sometimes?
No.
No, because at trial, it's all discoverable, but the court can maintain control and tell them, no, if you want to talk to Susie B, we will bring her forward.
Right.
You can interview her.
Yes.
And the judge will say, either I allow her as a witness, or no, she's not important. And then that's all the defense gets is Susie B, and she either is needed for trial, then they get Susie Beautiful or whatever. And they actually might get something. They're not going to get her address, but they're going to get her as a person on the stand, or the judge will say no, and they don't allow.
Yeah, if the defense wants access to somebody, because they send out their defense investigators, if they want access to any of my witnesses, I will make them available. Whether or not that the witnesses, I tell them, it's up to you. You can talk to them or not. Mm. But I need to pick you up, and I'm going to take you to the station, and they can interview you here, and it's up to you what you want to say. I just can't tell the defense investigator. They don't want to talk to you. But I'll go get them, and I'll bring them in.
Yeah, but so on top of that, you have to remember that most of the witnesses, not all of them, but most of the witnesses are either known to the victim or the suspect somehow, because they were in proximity when the event happened or the events leading up to it. So if, you know, simply, where did you purchase the vehicle? Well, from Bal Chevrolet. Okay, well, that's not a secret witness. That's where they purchased the vehicle. So they'll go back to them, and you have a witness there that they're going to know about. Or, well, who saw him, you know, who claims that A, B, and C happened, and they were the ones that called the police? Well, they're going to pull the 911 tape, and you can hear her voice, and you know the voice of your neighbor, you know. So yeah.
even though
we can keep the information secure, doesn't mean that they don't already know who it is.
And how much protection can you guarantee a witness or a potential?
Can't guarantee.
Right,
he's been raising his hand.
Sorry, well, I just had a quick question. Are these murder books becoming digital or digitized, or are they still just...
I've tried to digitalize everything, you know, put all the murders in the information in the computer, but somebody still writes it in a freaking book.
Let me explain why there's such an issue with that. Number one, when she wrote Heather Gary on this business card, and she wrote Heather Gary on this business card, okay, you can tell that it's the same person who wrote them, but they're not the same. So that's different. This is original evidence. This is a copy. We have to make sure that we keep the original evidence. We have to be able to testify to it. Some of that, like our chronological, we need to keep because cops lie. Oh.
We forget.
As a supervisor, I want the original so I can say whether it's something she wrote, something somebody else wrote. That's the original. You digitize that, and now who's it available to?
Everybody.
I don't want that information out until the last possible minute when I have to give it out. And obviously not Heather's name, but something that where witness A told me A, B, and C. I don't want anybody else to know that until I have to produce it in court. That's what I want it known. Other than that, we want to keep the information secure. Some people, some agencies are going digital, but for the most part, they're going to keep it in a closed system. Mm. But even that's subject to the problems. But what happens when that EMP comes, you know, just before the zombies? what happens to the digital format? Unless it's on a hard disk, it's gone. So that's why we maintain blue books. Yes, she can get away with typing a whole bunch of stuff. And yes, she updates the information on my record. But you can't move the whole book digital, because once you do, it's got too many other evidentiary problems.
Can you give examples of cops lying and why?
and names and serial numbers?
Motor motors. Let me just back up to the simple part. When I was in Rampart, I was put in as a supervisor during the investigation. I had no knowledge of the investigation whatsoever. And I get told, hey, you're going to gangs next DP. Okay, cool. I thought I was going to get to stay work at 312, but you're putting me back on 5 days a week. You got unlimited overtime. I am a whore for overtime. All right, boss, I'll do it. So I get unlimited overtime. Great. Well, thanks. Nobody told me there was an investigation going on. Right? Nobody told me all these things. Craig Hewitt and Nino Darden and Ray Perez had been going on. So I get to the unit, and they're like, "Well, you know about the investigation?" No, I'm a sergeant. I'm a sergeant of police. I don't know about the investigation, but I know I need you guys to get your asses out there and do some work. Well, we're all being followed. Okay, so what's the problem with that? Well, it prevents us from doing our job. I'm sorry, I'm a sergeant of police. Are you telling me that you want to go do something illegal? No, but we don't want somebody looking over our shoulder. Hey, worst case scenario, you get into a shooting. And when you get into a shooting, that police officer who's watching you now has to come to your aid. And they look at me like, Son of a bitch. Part of the issue with two people who didn't grow up together, who were put in a black and white together, is they have to trust each other with their lives. Okay? Now, if the guy calls me an asshole, and I call him an asshole back, do I really want to get suspended for a day? Hmm. Maybe I didn't say asshole. Maybe I said something else. Chucklehead. I don't remember what I said. So what is my partner going to remember? I don't know. And when does it come up? Okay, you have 110 contacts a day. Do you remember everyone? No, you don't. Okay, now what you put down on paper should be what happened. And for the most part, it is. Have you guys, any of you ever read an actual homicide investigative report? It says, unknown suspect walked up and shot victim. Victim was dead. That's all we put in the report. Why? Because that's public record. That's what it says. The book has a lot more stuff in it. Okay, but that's, and when you talk about cops maybe lying, do cops lie? I'm sure they do. Does your wife know where you are right now? When you're at the bar? You know, does she know that you stopped and, you know, had that ice cream soda on the way home? My wife knows because she checks my... but seriously...
Her murder book.
Yeah, her murder book. But seriously, there's, you know, what? Where is it a lie? Did I see my partner push the suspect up against the car? Yeah, I did. Did I see my partner put the handcuffs on him? Let's see. Well, no, I was watching that guy. I was watching the other suspect. Someone pushed him up against the car. Did I see? Yeah, I did. Why? What are they saying? You follow? I was there. Did he do something wrong? No, he didn't do shit wrong. And we're being accused again of he did something wrong. And I was there. I know he didn't do anything wrong. But was I watching when he actually put the handcuffs on? No, I wasn't. I wasn't. But I got to say I was. Otherwise, they're going to sustain the pushing up against the car is going to come back okay, but the way he handcuffed him is going to come back wrong, and my partner is going to be suspended for 2 days. You know, does that make sense? Okay, I'm not saying that cops always lie, but I'm saying that cops will take that into account as far as their recounting of the way events occur. But does that change what the victim tells them? No. The victim, everybody in that Section 14, those witnesses, we take it verbatim. Why? I've had witnesses tell me, okay, what do I have to say to get you the result you want? That's not the way it works. I had a multi-three defendant case where number two defendant, the first guy we got convicted of first degree murder. Second guy, when we got him, his name was Jose Luis Amaro. You tell me what I have to say to help you get number three. Whatever I have to do, because I don't want to get first degree. I said, I don't want you to tell me what happened. And he's telling me this in front of the DA's office. And at the time, I was actually in the middle of a divorce, and my partner made some mention of it somehow. And so when my partner walked out of the room, he said to me, he said, you know, for $500, I know people that can take care of that. I'm thinking, $500.
Ladies and gents, I'm afraid we're out of time. So if we could thank our guests.
Thank our guests.
I want to remind everybody to get validated before you leave.
Always get validated, baby. That's right.
You're looking good.
That's right. You're looking good. You know, Travis, you're looking good. Yeah, that's right, baby. That's right. That's it.